Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast. I'm your host, as always, Greg Johnson, and joining me today to discuss the North London Derby, a whole week of Champions League and Europa League football, is Carl Anker. How are you doing, Carl?
Hello, true believers.
Back on the pod again?
I know, can't keep me away.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. And Tom Marshall-Bailey from football.london. How are things with you?
Good morning, yeah, not too bad, thank you.
Yeah, you were at the Emirates, White Hart Lane. I'm getting the two stadiums mixed up and cannot do that. How was it for you?
Disappointing. In a word, yes.
Were your loyalties maybe to the red side of the fixture?
Yeah, slightly. I think Spurs were brilliant, though. They were everything Arsenal had to be and weren't in that fixture, to be honest.
Oof. Well, we may as well get straight into it then. The North London Derby, as you may have heard, ended Spurs 2, Arsenal 0. A fitting finale for the North London Derby at White Hart Lane. Obviously, Spurs are moving next season to move to Wembley. Their current stadium is going to get knocked down for a new one, but they kind of had to win this to make sure that the ground was still sacred when they came back, didn't they?
Yeah. The North London Derby for the last three or four seasons has been the best game in English football, in my opinion. It encapsulates everything that's good about English football. It's slightly chaotic. There are bits of technical skill, and there's just bits of just headless chicken and a couple of red cards, which is what you want to watch the Premier League for. It was a great game. I think, you know, this will probably go down in history as a 2-0 with an asterisk in front, because 2-0, thanks to the marvellous performance by Cech. I think what was really impressive about this victory was how pedestrian it looked and how, come the end of the second half, it could have been 4 or 5, such was the amount of chances that Tottenham were having.
Honestly, I didn't think Spurs had to be that good. That wasn't one of their best performances this season. That's probably the most damning thing from an Arsenal perspective, was Spurs didn't even have to play that well and just tore through them at ease. I mean, Victor Wanyama just completely ran the show in midfield. Mm. I didn't think Harry Kane, Dele Alli, Christian Eriksen were particularly great. I think of that front four, arguably Son for me was the most effective player of the lot. I think he was absolutely brilliant. He just gave Oxlade-Chamberlain nightmares on that left-hand side, despite Wenger's protestations that they had loads of clear-cut chances. They didn't particularly look free-flowing going forward.
Well, I think they actually had quite a few shots, but only one on target.
Yeah.
Which the damning part, really.
The Ramsey shot that obviously Lloris tipped wide. But no, they there's just no coherence about this team. Mm. And there's been probably a lot of Arsenal fans have fallen into the trap of thinking, this is the solution. We needed to go 3 at the back all this, you know, ages ago, because it's instigated 3 wins in a row. Well, Tottenham just completely shot that down.
Well, it didn't look great against Middlesbrough. It looked like, I got a bit of flack on Twitter for saying this, because people were saying, oh, you don't trust Arsene Wenger and his coaches. I'm not saying that, but it looked like it was a roll of the dice to some extent against Middlesbrough. Yep. It was good against City, better, I thought. They dropped back into it, used it almost like a defensive formation rather than how Poch used it to get more players forward, and that worked quite well for them locking City out. Is it a case you're saying lack of urgency? Is it because they're trying to get a system going at the end of the season, which other teams have been coaching all season to get ready for when they needed it?
Absolutely, yeah. They looked on Sunday like there was an incident in the first half where Monreal, I think it was for the Kane's cross to the far post that Dele Alli headed wide. I think Gibbs and Monreal both just had a bit of a argument on the field, sort of both looking at each other saying, I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. I don't know what my responsibility is in this role. Monreal was kind of too close to Koscielny, and that gave Spurs loads of room on the right. Trippier was overlapping Eriksen every time. Gibbs just went AWOL for that opportunity and then did so for the remainder of the game. He looked like a player. He shouldn't have started on Sunday. He looked like a player going through the motions, I think.
He hasn't been good enough for a while. I think Gibbs is one of those players where you'd think of him and you're like, oh, you know, he's still young. He'll crack on a bit. And then you Google him and you figure out, oh, wait, he's how old?
Yeah.
Why isn't he kicked on? And this is the thing with Arsenal now. They've got so many players who you expected to kick on, but weren't that haven't got anywhere. There was that famed British contingent of players that Wenger promised he'd get us in a decade who are still raw potential. Like, have we seen the best of Wilshere? Have we seen the best of Aaron Ramsey? No, all these players are probably underperforming. Mm-hmm. Like, if you compare what Ramsey looked like in 2013 before that injury where he was scoring 8 goals in 13 games or something or other to what he is now, like, why is he stalled? Mm-hmm. And the blame has to be left at the manager.
I mean, that brings you back to both your points that Spurs are showing Arsenal up in what they used to be so proud of. I mean, Pochettino, his British core, he's not even advertising it like that because it's just the fact that they're the best players he's got. They're training well. They work the system. It works like a dream.
Yeah. Like, what is Xhaka doing? What is Xhaka doing for Arsenal? What is he? Is he a six? Is he an eight? Is he meant to be playing passes here? Is he meant to be snuffing out danger? We don't know. Wenger doesn't seem to know when you listen to the press conferences.
Well, he described him in two different ways earlier in the season. He called him both a deep-line playmaker and a box-to-box midfielder. So even Wenger is sounding confused over what he's meant to be doing in the side and what type of player he is.
$35 million on a player, you don't know what the best thing is for him. Mm. And this three-at-the-back system, like, it worked against Manchester City because there was loads of tactical fouling. Like, if you looked at what Arsenal were doing in that FA Cup semi-final, I mean,
some of it wasn't even tactical.
No, some of it wasn't even tactical. Gabriel broke David Silva, and that's the reason why Arsenal won that game, because they went, all right, you're the guy linking all the play. I'm just going to kick you in the bum a bit. Whereas, again, Arsenal tepid, soft underbelly. No one's doing any running. Sanchez is like, fine, I'll try, but if this goes to 60 minutes and no one's doing anything, I'm going to cool off because, frankly, why not?
Which, I guess, Spurs are a much bigger, more physically capable team. I mean, I was looking at going on Wikipedia again, looking at their squad, I think only Danny Rose is the only regular player under 6 foot in that side. Even guys like Son are 6 foot and more. Dele Alli, everyone thinks a young kid, football is all small. He's 6'2". So that's not a side you can kick off the field and overpower. But Wenger blamed soft defending, a soft penalty for his loss. He did say Spurs deserved it. But if Arsene Wenger bought into more specialism on the pitch, rather than having this idea that we'll just put the right players with good football technique on the field, they'll bring it together through their own chemistry. When people say Arsene Wenger's outdated, is this what they're talking about?
It taps into the whole idea for so many years now that they've needed a new keeper, a new central defender, a new central midfielder, a new striker, a whole new spine. That seems to have just been like a stick to kind of hit Arsenal with for years, that they need leaders in those four positions throughout the spine of the team. Now, Wenger has actually gone and addressed those failings and bought in Cech, Mustafi, Xhaka. He's moved Sanchez into a central position to try and address that. Intrigued that he's shunted him back to the left wing.
He said that Sanchez prefers it out there, which,
yep.
I mean, maybe this is unfair, but it sounds to me like if you're the manager, Sanchez up front works better for the whole team, not just himself. Like, there's extra pace up there. So surely it's weak management to go, the player doesn't want to do it, I'll just move him back to where he wants to go.
Exactly. It's signings that he's made. It's surely a worry that he's, you know, tried to actually address the failures that he's made in the transfer market. And those calibre of players, those should have been the signings to kick Arsenal on and start to make a title challenge. And you look at them in sixth place now, okay, couple of games in hand on Liverpool and games in hand on City and United, but there's no way they're finishing the top four.
Look
now.
At Mustafi. Mustafi came in, he looked superb. He looked like the leader Arsenal needed. And then it's now he's playing, he's been dragged down to the level of other Arsenal players, and that can only be...
But this is what I find interesting. Then is it actually the talent, or is it the whole Arsenal ethos? When we talk about the British core, again, we compare and contrast that with what Pochettino has done. There's a sense that there's more of a drive to Pochettino in how he's tried to demand for his players. Not in a kind of, you know, martial kind of way. He's an arm around the shoulder kind of coach, but he's really pushing these guys to improve themselves. Whereas Wenger's, it just seems a bit, he's very hands-on on the training ground, but there's still a sense around Arsenal that they're quite a laissez-faire kind of team, as in they just let the players kind of figure out for themselves, and maybe that's just not enough.
On the touchline on Sunday, I think you've hit the nail on the head. We were both at White Hart Lane, sat very close to the two dugouts, and Pochettino was stood on the touchline the whole game, and he wasn't always barking out orders. He did so. There was a moment in like the 92nd minute, I think, when it was a crossfield pass which went out of play, and he went absolutely berserk and saying, "Calm down. Why are you doing that? Why do we need to start, you know, trying to play expansively when we can close the game out here?" And I just thought that attention to detail and that ability to rouse his players at the right moments during the game was just in stark contrast to Wenger. I mean, playing Giroud on Sunday, to me, was just absolutely baffling. Like, Spurs press high. You need a counter-attacking option to play against that. You adapt to the fixture. To play Giroud in that fixture, and a few Arsenal fans have said to me on Twitter, well, A, he's got quite a decent record. That's why I think he played him against Manchester City the previous Sunday, because Giroud has got a good record against City, and I think he felt he could probably bully Otamendi. He did that in the fixture at the Etihad last season. But that was a complete, you know, waste of time. Walcott against Leicester up top, complete waste of time. Mm. Don't get me wrong, Welbeck had, I think, four starts consecutively from the West Brom game onwards and didn't lay a glove on any of the opponents. But he was the option to go with, in that he would have drifted wide. He would have taken Alderweireld into positions or Vertonghen into positions they didn't want to be in. And that would free up space for Sanchez. Surely that's not difficult to work out.
Wenger's too nice. He puts too much faith in players I've been on before him.
He talked a lot about Arsenal there. But Spurs, I mean, Natasha Henry actually has raised a question on Twitter. With Spurs now guaranteed to finish above Arsenal, St. Tottenham's day is cancelled this year. The gap also now stands at 17 points. As you in the press comments, Wenger refused to kind of go into whether those points also showed the gap in quality between the two teams. But anyway, Natasha asks, do the panel think that one season proves there is a changing of the guard in North London, or do we need to wait a few more years to see it?
I argue that it's not one season. I'd argue that it's been three or four seasons.
It's definitely last season. I kind of think Arsenal's second place finish last year was a bit hollow,
yeah,
personally.
Papering over some cracks.
Yeah.
I mean, I was reading The Guardian. There was a great profile on Pochettino and the philosophies brought to Tottenham Hotspur. And I think one of the interesting stats was Pochettino, one of his first early games at Spurs, it was a 2-1 victory over Aston Villa. And of the 18-man squad that was in that squad, only eight of them have survived. Now, like, Pochettino, in the 3 years he's been in charge, has turned over an amazing amount of players, got so many players playing better to what would be expected of them. He's got a team playing far greater than some of his parts. This isn't a blip. This is an upward curve.
But they do need to win a trophy. For me, they need some form of tangible success to justify the brilliance that, you know, Pochettino's instilled into this team. It would be a shame for a team that good. And they were brilliant against Chelsea, but for me, in that semi-final, there was still that kind of inability to you know, get over the finish line. And that until they do that, I still think there will be doubts in people's heads. And as brilliant as the result was for them on Sunday, the Chelsea's performance at Everton and the result, I cannot see any way that they're going to overhaul them now. I can't see a two-result swing.
No.
With four games remaining.
If they win on Friday night, they're just a point away from Chelsea, and Chelsea don't play until Monday.
But it is Middlesbrough at home on the Monday, and I can't make a case for them.
Middlesbrough who drew 2-2 with Man City. We'll get onto that shortly. But just before we move on from the North London derby, we say that it might have even been 2 years now that Spurs have been on top. But is there any sense, this might be a bit mischievous from me, but with Spurs moving to the Wembley, you can call it that, they're going to have a new stadium built up. That's going to cost a lot of money. They've got a lot of great young players, but Kyle Walker is apparently already making noises that he wants to move on. He's had a conflict with Pochettino, apparently. He wants to play two games a week. Pochettino feels like he can't for fitness issues, yada, yada. Is there any sense that Spurs are where Arsenal were at a few years ago when Wenger had this great young team full of guys like Fabregas, Van Persie, and they started to get picked off one by one by richer, bigger clubs, and then they moved to the Emirates. They couldn't put the money back into the squad to retain that level, and unfortunately, Wenger, I mean, for all his faults, kept getting that top four with some very difficult circumstances. I know it's already become a trope within some circles to make those comparisons, but Are either of you worried about what happens to Spurs over the next few years? I mean, Pochettino is a fantastic manager. Daniel Levy's probably the hardest negotiator in football. But even if the first player to leave the project, that's going to be a bit of a landmark, isn't it?
I was just going to say, I think incomings are almost as much of a concern for Spurs as outgoings, because that team at the moment, and I've had this discussion with our Spurs writer for the website, Alistair Gold, on so many occasions this season. And he says to me, I can't name you a player in that 11 that I would consider dispensable, someone that I would say would drop out for a new signing. Yet the argument I put to him every time is, look what Fergie did at United. Every summer, Scholes talks about this all the time. He brought a player in to unsettle that starting 11 to say, do you know what, you need to up your game again. If you're going to win another Premier League title, you're going to have to up your game again. And I think Pochettino has to do that. They're being linked with players like Zaha, Michael Keane, Ross Barkley. Personally, I don't think any of those three players would come in and command the starting place in the starting 11. And for me, that's the balance he has to strike this summer, is to find a player that can not sort of, that doesn't unsettle the harmony that he's got in that group at the moment, but equally will go in and tread on a few toes and say, do you know what, I'm going to put your first team place up for threat.
Well, you've got to bear in mind, Spurs had a terrible transfer window, but it just took Christian Eriksen to go, all right, I'm going to bridge the gap. And Eriksen's playing unbelievable. And it's just taken one extra player in that Spurs team to buy more into the philosophy of Pochettino, to play a little bit better, to do the 20% extra that, you know, used to happen at Arsenal to cover a paper crack. And I think Spurs will be fine.
It's kind of, you know, how brilliant they've been, kind of masked how disastrous that transfer window was, really.
Awful transfer window.
Moussa Sissoko. I mean, it's still baffling, that signing. It's still just the most bizarre thing that's happened in the transfer window in some time.
Spurs are in this interesting point, similar to Liverpool, really, where both of these teams are overachieved. Both of them, you know, based on their wage structure especially, have no right being in top four contention. But both of them lack the squad depth to sustain this, to sustain a top four challenge next season once this Manchester club sort themselves out. I think the big thing for the FA Cup semi-final wasn't that, you know, Chelsea, well, this or whatever. It's just that Spurs lack the squad depth. You know, Chelsea went, all right, we're not playing well. Here's Diego Costa and Eden Hazard. And Spurs, like, we got Janssen and Doku.
They stuck Son at left wing back.
Which is the problem. So Spurs simultaneously have to thicken out their squad and also improve it. I believe it is possible, because Pochettino is a manager of a type, and he's got young players coming through that.
And guys like Harry Winks are literally coming to fruition.
Yeah. You know, Harry Winks, depending on what Spurs fan you talk to, Harry Winks is either the second coming of Luka Modric or just a very good centre midfielder.
Yeah.
Which I'll take either one.
Just before we move on, very last question. It's not entirely related to the North London derby, but I thought with both sides changing their shape, it would be a good one to touch on. Obviously, as I said before, the match pitched Spurs in their 4-2-3-1 against Arsenal in 3-4-2-1. And Matt Browniecake on Twitter asked, what formation do you think has been the best this season? Why? And which match and teams have kind of embodied this for you?
Well, so last time I was on this podcast, I said football tactics are cyclical. So there's no dominant thing. Just every now and again, one thing becomes in vogue because everyone's been doing another thing in vogue. So it's got to be a four. But that said, still the 3-4-2-1 because of what Chelsea have done with it and the ridiculous run they've gone on. You know, I think the best way I'm going to encapsulate is the Chelsea 4-0 over Everton, because Everton tried doing it at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Chelsea just played them off the park.
Ripped them to pieces, because man for man.
It shows that this formation, that's the worst thing we can do after this season is for all of us to believe that our various sides need to play 3-4-2-1.
It's easy to forget, given how many sides have done it well now. Yeah. When Chelsea actually moved to this, everyone said, well, this is a very difficult system to both play and maintain.
Yeah.
And it's a credit to Chelsea and to Spurs that they've managed to do that. As we've already said, Arsenal have struggled.
Very hard to do. Don't not think it's the silver bullet for your team to start playing well.
I think Spurs' victory over Chelsea would be the game for me, in that Pochettino went toe-to-toe with Conte and played that formation. And a lot of people pre-match, when he confirmed in his pre-match interview, he said, yep, we're going three at the back. A lot of people that night were thinking, that's a bold call, that to try and take on this Chelsea team who've dominated the league so far. And for Spurs to just, I mean, they were brilliant that night. Yeah. And that, I think that was the night I think everyone realised that they were the real deal, to be honest.
And I think that underlines everything we've said in the podcast so far on Spurs, in that they went man for man. And they got proven, man for man, probably the best team at home in the league. And as you see from the table, they've got 50 points at home, more than any other side in the Premier League this season. But as we say, without that squad depth after that first starting 11, and without White Hart Lane in the future, it'll be interesting to see what happens there. We're going to move now to the race for the top four. Arsenal might have lost against Spurs, but results kind of did go their way elsewhere. It gives them a chance, potentially, somehow, to come back. I know we said they're outsiders, they are, but they could somehow mathematically still do it. United drew with Swansea, City could only draw against Borough 2-2, although Liverpool beat Watford 1-0. Are the Reds, Jurgen Klopp's team, in the driving seat for top four?
Yeah, I think the top four as it is the top four. I don't think Manchester United or Arsenal have a sniff. I think United are going to aim for the Europa League, and I think Arsenal are going to Arsenal it. So,
do you agree with that, Tom?
Yeah, and I can see next Sunday being a damp squib of a 1-1 draw. I think Wenger will fail to beat Mourinho again. I think he will probably rest quite a few players, yet get another draw away from home. But I can see that being a real kind of slog of a game, to be honest with you. Two sides that just don't look like they can click, to be honest with you. And I think I don't particularly think Liverpool or Manchester City right now are great. Like, Chelsea and Tottenham are so far ahead in terms of quality, it's quite frightening.
Sergio Aguero could be out for the season. They'll join Ibrahimovic, who's already on the sidelines for Man United. Liverpool obviously got Sadio Mane out. Not Gabriel Jesus, sorry. Philippe Coutinho was taken off as a precaution, we think, against Watford. Gabriel Jesus is only just back. He missed a lot of chances against Boy, but did score the equaliser. Is it a case of last man standing in the top four?
Yeah, I think it's last man. Well, this is the thing about not only the Premier League, but a lot of leagues. Like, the Championship especially is a great example of, to get promoted, you don't necessarily have to have the best team. You just have to have enough players to get through the slog of all of those matches. And this is why I think City's always going to have an advantage in the top four. This is why City, Chelsea and United should have an advantage in top four over the other sides, because they've just got bigger squad depth. But I think this top four as it is will probably be the top four. And also, it's the most intriguing top four for next season. I really want to see Liverpool and Spurs and what they do with Champions League money, which we just know is more money and wages. So we'll see.
But Lord Baruda wants to ask us about United injury problems on Twitter. Wants a strength of Mourinho, as he never really had players that would drop in like flies. He does now. He's struggling to keep his players fit. Pogba has been the big loss in midfield.
It's not a question. He's just reeling off some facts here.
Yeah, but at the back as well, United have lost so many players to injury as well at centre back. How does Mourinho patch this side up and get, even if they're going for the top four, they've still got to win that Europa League, haven't they?
He does my head in. He's got his players and he's got the rest of them. And the problem is, if he could have avoided this problem very easily, if he had just given some more minutes to Fosu Mensah, to Axel Dzembe, if he'd just
But he won the title when he didn't play a whole load of players for Chelsea. You got, like Conte now, he had a very small pool of players. He played regularly in the first team. Is this just bad luck?
As a particularly annoyed United fan,
a lot of them have been impact injuries, like stuff like Ibrahimovic wasn't necessarily overtraining. It was a bad landing.
I think so. My example of this is what's going on with Eric Bailly. Eric Bailly, he's played. Mourinho's complained about how Smalling and Jones need to be brave and take painkiller injections and possibly take years off. Look, folks, anytime you hear stuff about a player taking a painkiller injection to play a game of football, they're probably taking a couple of months off their career. Like, it's not fun to take an injection to play a game of football. It's very, very dangerous. John Terry used to do this a lot for Chelsea. There is a timeline where John Terry will be in his 60s in a wheelchair because he's done this so often. This is not a good thing to do, to play through the pain barrier. It's not nice. And the fact that Mourinho is constantly asking Smalling and Jones to do this so he doesn't have to keep playing Bailly is a half-truth. Like, he doesn't have to keep playing Bailly. He has Timo Fosu-Mensah. You see, if Mourinho had done his job properly, so if this situation arises, you can just drop Fosu-Mensah in the system, Bailly wouldn't be crocked. Mourinho brings upon himself and then says something silly in a press conference, and we all fall for it every time, and it makes me so annoyed.
Against City, again, that was a game that just needed spark of brilliance, and you felt like it was a kind of game that Pogba could have made a decisive difference in. Well, both sides looked like they kind of lacked that kind of ingenuity in attack, but I felt like that was the kind of game where he would have really stamped his mark on it. And it's frustrating because I do think as well that beyond the injuries, yes, United have clearly been hindered by that, but there's still no excuse for not being able to beat a Swansea City side. Like, that shouldn't be able to mask the talent that was out on that field the other day. I still think that's a poor result in the circumstances, irrespective of what injury crisis you have to deal with. That was a Swansea team there for the beating, for me, despite the fact they are, desperately trying to stay up. Didn't pose any sort of threat until a cheap free kick was given away, and then a piece of Sigurdsson brilliance, obviously,
What a free kick.
I was kind of glad that that got the credit and praise it deserved, because I felt like it was just like, it's a 25-yard free kick. To get the ball up and down like that into that posted stamp top corner was Unbelievable.
Sigurdsson has also, I think, been involved in more goals than any other player outside of the top seven.
I can't wait to see who goes in for him. I think it'd be great, Everton. I think he'd be good if he went to newly promoted Newcastle.
Yeah, there's a lot of assumption that that's going to happen, isn't there? But we'll have to see
There are at least six sides who would be in the top half of the Premier League who would be immediately improved by Gylfi Sigurdsson. Heck, take him back to Spurs. I reckon he'll still do it. He'll reckon he'll
Pochettino
really
has
good.
Talked about it with regretful tones about him going. But one player who in midfield did make a difference for Liverpool, at least, was Emre Can, who scored, well, should we just call it the goal of the season now? It was ridiculous, wasn't it?
It was lovely.
It was a wonderful goal. We got this goal. We've had a few questions through. Chris, C Armband on Twitter says, was Emre Can A, wonderful, or B, stupendous? We'll get onto that in a second. Another question from Across the Keeper asks, which goal was better, Emre Can, Olivier Giroud, Henrik Mkhitaryan, or Andy Carroll?
Andy Carroll's goal is better. I like to give the rub to goals that come from players who you don't ever expect it to ever happen from again.
I've got to agree.
Like a human trebuchet, wasn't he?
I just think the power that he gets on the ball is just ridiculous.
Like, how can a man that big move like that?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Like, Chan's was brilliant. They're all brilliant. Mm. Giroud's was great in that it went in off the bar. Goals that go in off the upright. Yeah. Great.
Mkhitaryan's is offside.
But I like, at the same time, I like goals where the opposition fans go, ugh!
Yes.
When there's a bit of controversy. Yeah. All four of those goals have got a little bit extra to them in certain ways. Like, I'd probably say Chan is the most technically spectacular, even more so than Mkhitaryan. Like, Mkhitaryan was beautiful improvisation in the moment, but Chan just, I don't know, I don't understand how he did that. It was just ridiculous.
I don't, but I'm still going to give it to Big Andy Carroll.
Yeah,
purely for just...
Got big agree. AC.
Got just to agree. Yeah.
I think Sam, this West Ham fan once described the bicycle kick done by Dean Ashton as like throwing a mattress off the side of a bridge into a river. Like, that's what it looked like when Dean Ashton was in flight, and I think that's a good description of what
Dean
Andy Carroll...
Dean Ashton in flight. Yeah. What
Andy Carroll
what
in flight, it's a bit like a king-size mattress being chucked off a bridge into a river. Why
I
not?
Like it. I like it. Other results in the Premier League this weekend. West Brom lost 1-0 to Leicester, who quite literally outfoxed the Baggies, who conceded the goal through their own mistake of Salomon Rondon with an awful ball backwards. Ndidi, again, immense in the middle. How big of a player is he going to be for Leicester going forward?
It's not Shakespeare, it's Ndidi. It's the fact they've Lovely. Got a...
Oh, you mean Craig Shakespeare? I thought you were talking about his...
I thought it was just a beautifully poetic Karl Anka reference.
I wish it was.
Own it.
Yeah, it was. Indeed, he is the player they've needed, and they're going to be fine in maybe, you know, they're going to be 8th to 14th for the next couple of seasons, I reckon. Mm. Bit disappointing that Pulis, once his West Brom team's hit 40 points, they've just...
On the beach. They haven't scored a goal in a while, and it's starting to get a bit of an annoyance for their fans. Moving on to another game that lacked goals. Stoke versus West Ham play it to a 0-0 draw. Jack Butland, pretty good though.
Yeah.
Made sure that his side kept the clean sheet. But Crispy Cook asks, should Mark Hughes' position be under review after a rather stale and mediocre season?
I don't think so. No.
He's kind of on a hiding to nothing. He's damned whether he does or he doesn't.
There's this band of clubs, as Carl says, from that kind of, you know, 8th down to 14th. Like, they're never going to break above 8th position. Mm. It's like Everton are going to be consigned to 7th till the end of time. Like, there is just a kind of a setup in the league at the moment that, you know, money talks. Money's going to dictate where certain clubs in this division finish. Stoke fans have to realise that they're not going to finish above 8th unless there is a huge amount of money poured into that football club.
Mm.
And... okay, they've fallen slightly below standards this season, but I don't think that necessarily means that a change of management is required. But I think Hughes does a great job season after season. That Stoke team doesn't have a divine right to stay in the Premier League.
But it's just they're weirdly consistent at being inconsistent, aren't they, really?
It's just what Mark Hughes does. Again, Ted Knutson, Stats Bomb editor, just looked at the underlying stats of all Mark Hughes' sides and just went, this is what happens. Mark Hughes is... the C plus manager. He will give you a very average. He will win 50% of his games and make of that what you will. He's good enough to keep you in the Premier League, but he's not good enough to get you a cup or whatever. So it just depends on what you want as a fan. Stoke fans, yeah, if Stoke fans want to change from Mark Hughes, fair enough, but only get someone if that person is proven as a guaranteed upgrade.
Well, we may come on to that a little bit later with a question on managers around Europe this season. But moving on to the other games in the league this weekend. Palace lost 2-0 to Burnley. I think it's Burnley's first win on the road all season. Incredible.
And left an ultimate away fixture. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. While Sunderland were officially relegated after losing 1-0 to Bournemouth, Edin Džeković kept Hull in the fight for survival, however, by saving a penalty to salvage a draw 0-0 away against Southampton. There's a wonderful tweet. Let me find out who it was from before I read it out, because I don't want to steal his wonderful witticism. Logie on Twitter said, Sunderland relegated after 10 years, nicknamed the Black Cats. 9 lives, pretty poetic. I think that kind of sums it up, really. You know, they had 9 chances to escape. They did some grand escapes as well, but this time they just couldn't get out of the mire, could they?
It's just... I think it's nice for everyone that they've finally gone. It's
long
like
time
been,
coming.
Yeah, it's like just been watching someone die a painful death. And I think Bournemouth almost did them a favour this weekend to just finally put them out of their misery. It's a club which is just rotten from top to bottom at the moment. They have a manager who looks out of his depth, frankly. Mm. The resources weren't there to invest in a playing squad, which has not been good enough for years now. Mm. And for me, the championship next season is going to be a very... I look at Middlesbrough and think to myself, okay, they are clearly not good enough for the Premier League, but I think they'll probably make a real fist of it when they go down, in that they're probably in a similar position to Norwich, Middlesbrough, in that they won't lose a lot of players because I don't think that many of their players are good enough for the Premier League, yet they're also going to be up the top end of the Championship.
A bit like how West Brom used to be before they settled into life in the Premier League, like a yo-yo club.
I don't necessarily think Sunderland are in that position, though.
No, they are a true crisis club. And to sum that up, there's been a great meme created by their relegation. I'm really sorry because I don't actually know which way you say this Twitter handle, but HMCL and... Dress? I don't know. But yeah, he's unpaid content maker is his handle on Twitter at the moment. And he did a wonderful thread of every single like, he's going to give you a little nugget of disaster from recent history in Sunderland. Let's go around all the clubs now. If you haven't seen it already, I think Johnny Gable's done one on Newcastle.
The Newcastle one's hilarious.
Newcastle one is hilarious. And one about, who was it? Joe Kinnear going to Birmingham to scout a player that was already on the books in Newcastle.
I quite liked Asprella. I think it was Asprella turning up 40 minutes early rather than his usual 20 minutes late to training because he didn't realise the clocks had changed.
I can sympathise with that. And we've had a question actually on Southampton, who I said earlier, it drew with Hull 0-0. Felix Keith asks, why are they awful in front of goal this season? Why is Forster rubbish, and have fans got a right to be upset with Claude Puel, who famously last week was ranked ahead of Ronald Koeman in the L'Equipe, think top 50 managers of the season?
I saw that. I saw that yesterday. Why are they awful in front of goal? Because They're caught between two stars right now. I think that, you know, for much of the start of the season, they're still trying to play long ball football. But, you know, Shane Long isn't Graziano Pelle. You know, Pelle wasn't great, but Pelle was better for that system than Shane Long. Charlie Austin got injured. You know, they're
and then Gabbiadini got injured. I think that's the issue, isn't it? Really?
They're awful in front of goal because they haven't had the necessary players up top.
I would query your long ball accusation of them. Because, I mean, when I've watched a lot of Southampton, they got that four-man midfield, or sometimes a diamond with guys like Hirschberg and Stephen Davis. They play some nice stuff. It just doesn't penetrate, really.
They've got some good midfield. I think Oriol Romeo's been absolutely brilliant this season. He's been a real revelation for them. But yeah, they have been crippled by the injuries that they've had. And
I mean, Puel's been compared to Wenger in some ways. Is this a case of, again, another manager who relies on the talent up front to make the difference, where the system is, you know, not as a hands-on as maybe Pochettino's is?
I do understand Southampton fans' frustrations with Claude Puel. And it's a difficult one, in that getting to the EFL Cup final was obviously huge for Southampton. And he deserves praise for that. The way that they beat Liverpool in the semi-finals was brilliant. He did a job on Jurgen Klopp, I think, in those two games. But Southampton have been, you know, Southampton fans, again, it's this... kind of this glass ceiling of eighth place in the Premier League. I think there is Southampton, probably more so than Stoke in some respects, have become accustomed to finishing in that, you know, eighth to tenth position. And I think I don't see anything from Puel this season to suggest that there's progress there. They're probably going to lose Van Dijk this summer.
Yep.
I think Gabbiadini's great. I think that was a real find and a really good piece of business. But
was that just the honeymoon spell? We're saying, we've had another question on the bottom end of the table. Sir Harvey Cruz asks, Would you guys like to see the Premier League have a relegation playoff similar to what they have in the Bundesliga? In the Bundesliga, the third to last team goes into a fight against the third highest team in the second division in a winner takes all battle over two legs to decide who gets into the Bundesliga next season. Is that something you'd like to see? Let's say it's Huddersfield versus Swansea to stay in the Premier League next season. Would you like to see that?
In two minds about it. I think more football, so yay, that's great, all for it, let's have some more footy. But at the same time, I also worry about the message it sends out. Like Huddersfield, for instance, this season, with a goal difference of like one in the Championship, like the golfing in class between the top two and the teams in the playoffs this season in the Championship is almost as marked as what it is at the bottom end of the Premier League. I don't necessarily feel it would be right to have two teams across two divisions competing against one another when, like at the moment, it looks like a straight shootout between Hull and Swansea, which I think is a lot fairer when they're on a level playing field. Mm. But that's just my
opinion. Then you would get that, and then at the end, whoever missed out in that straight shootout would then have to fight.
I think it's unfair, because also, like, if you're a Championship side and you... Say you're a Championship side, you've got the season. Everything clicked. The right players stayed fit. The right manager came in. The right loanee from the Premier League did the thing, and you managed to sneak into the playoffs, and you got to the final, and you won it. And then you've got to play a Premier League side, and you lose, and you have to do it all over again. No,
really old school, like 90s video game where it's really hard but really fun.
Oh, I don't know if it's really fun. It's just like it swallows up a lot of 10p.
One of those ones where you get to the end, and then your reward is to play the whole game backwards.
Yeah,
well, one of those old school arcade.
You remember
games,
it, so. But also
you start sweating and smiling, and yeah, it was great, yeah, and you don't want to ever play it again. That is football. It's football. We've had a semi-related question, talking about big teams in the top tier who have somehow saved themselves from relegation year after year. Hamburg have definitely taken advantage of this playoff system in the Bundesliga. They're one of the most historic clubs in Germany, but they are looking in serious trouble this season to actually go down properly with or without the playoff. We've had a question through, which would be bigger? Obviously, Newcastle were relegated last season. Probably bring West Ham into this. What's bigger, those going down in the Premier League or Hamburg finally being relegated from the Bundesliga?
I'm going to say Hamburg, because I believe Hamburg have won the Bundesliga title a couple of times, whereas Newcastle, unfortunately, haven't won a title, English title, in a while. So,
yeah.
It's simple.
Hamburg.
Yeah. It just is.
Do you reckon they're going to bring themselves out of... Is this like Sunderland? Is this the year they finally get what's coming to them?
I think this is the year. Yeah. I remember watching the game a couple of years ago where it was... I think it was like a Lucas Holtby-led Hamburg.
It still is.
Lucas Holtby. Lewis Holtby-led no, this is it. They're off.
I enjoyed the idea that Lewis Holtby might have a brother who was following in his footsteps and just salvaging Hamburg.
Steve Holtby.
Good lad. Steve Holtby.
Moving now quickly to the Champions League. You might have heard it's back on this week. Tuesday night sees Real Madrid take on Atletico Madrid. Obviously, this is a fixture that has decided the actual Champions League final twice in the last 3 years. How will Diego Simeone approach this game? Obviously, it's a two-legger, with the second leg being at home for Atletico. Carl?
I think he's going to approach it with the same fury he approaches a Leicester game, which is just, we're going to find the thing that you don't like doing and make you do it over and over and over and over and over again, and then we're going to score one goal and we're going to box you out. I think this is a 1-0 Atletico Madrid game.
It ended 1-1 in their last visit to the Bernabeu in April in the Madrid derby in La Liga, with Griezmann scoring a very late equaliser in a game that Real dominated, I think it's fair to say. Ronaldo's been on fire in the Champions League this season. As good as Messi's been, his heroics, Ronaldo's heroics in the Champions League, it's kind of making him look like he could be in for another Ballon d'Or win. But which player do you think is going to decide it? Do you think there's another one Ronaldo's just going to go Super Saiyan, or can Griezmann kind of really put himself into that bracket? Because obviously at the Euros he missed that penalties. He's missed a few penalties as well. There's still a few doubts about his full-on ability in the big occasions.
I think Atletico will get a result tonight. I really fancy... I fancy him to get through to the final. I think they'll draw 1-1 tonight. And I can see them maybe drawing 0-0 in the return leg. I do think that this might be their best opportunity. Yeah, I think Griezmann is just continuing to be absolutely brilliant. I think he's going to be a real thorn in that Real Madrid team tonight.
Who are wobbling? They've let their their big lead slip and they're up against. I mean, they did win at the weekend 2-1 against Valencia, but Barcelona won as well. So it's still all to play for in the title race in the Liga.
It was
but
remarkable.
Did you think? We saw in 1999, obviously, with United going for the treble, and you know that it was all things very close. The momentum drove them on. But do you think it's having a negative effect on Real Madrid?
Possibly. I just think it's hard to defend titles on all three fronts. I think you know, the type of opposition you have to play in this late spell. So it's a late spell. You know, your top players are possibly injured or carrying knocks. You're playing 2 or 3 games a week, and you're playing the best teams in Europe. It's not like, oh, I'm going to play 14th and 16th and whatever. It's I've got to play a very good Valencia side. I know, not very good. I have to play Valencia side.
They've got better.
A better Valencia side. Mm. Then I've got to go play Atletico Madrid. Mm. Then I've got to go play this. Then I've got to go play another Atletico Madrid. And if I get to the final, I'm probably going to have to play either the best counter-attacking side in
the
Europe.
The best accountants.
Yes. Well, it's Monaco, so.
Well, we're getting the point.
The best, yeah.
Well, anyway. We talked about what Diego Simeone needs to do to react to Real Madrid, but is there anything that Zidane should be doing? Obviously, he's got some big questions up front. Asensio, does he play Isco as well? I mean, I think Bale's out anyway, but Benzema's not been great of late. He's got some tough decisions to make about who starts up front and who plays where. Morata as well is another player that could come in.
One of the players that I was going to suggest as one that I think could make a difference tonight is Isco. I think he's been great this season. I do wonder whether he's going to be someone that might come to the Premier League, to be honest, in that he... I mean, he'd be brilliant for so many teams in this country. Spurs seem to be perennially linked with him. I think he'd be absolutely perfect for Spurs. I think Atletico will have Real Madrid's number tonight, and I think Zidane needs to find. I would opt for Benzema, to be honest with you. I'd probably go for Benzema, Isco, Ronaldo as a front three. Because I think Isco can cause Atletico a few problems between defence and midfield, just dropping off into those spaces. I think Ronaldo and Benzema will probably operate more as a two, so it will almost be like almost a diamond in midfield with Casemiro sat a bit deeper. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be what I'd go with, because I think you need to get Ronaldo central to, you know, get in between the gaps between probably Jimenez or Juan Fran and Godin.
Well, we did see, actually, I think it was the second to last Madrid derby. But Zidane actually set up in a 4-4-1-1 with Isco behind Ronaldo. Ronaldo playing as a centre forward. So, I mean, how would you approach it if you were Zinedine Zidane?
I'd take Tom's method and pray, frankly. Isco is a superb player who would light up nearly every European side.
I'm also, all rumours point to the fact that he's extended his contract to 2022, so... I think he's going to be staying at
he's
Madrid.
He's going to be staying. He's going to be staying. Unless Daniel Levy like revives that weird Spurs Real Madrid partnership.
I don't think that went well for Spurs.
I don't think that was a thing. It was just like a thing to get us to not be mad that they sold Modric for cheap. See, look how quickly Spurs have improved.
But do we think that, I mean, Madrid is the most successful city in European football given the amount of European trophies they've won as a city between them, the two big clubs. Should this tie produce the winner this year?
No.
No?
Because Juventus have the best defence.
Ooh.
I think Juventus will win it as well.
Yeah. But you just said Atletico, it's going to be their year. Is this going to be their year to lose again in
the
final?
To get the better of Real Madrid.
Got you.
I think they will get the better of Real Madrid in European competition, but I think regardless of who wins tonight's tie, Juventus win the competition.
Which probably means you should move on to Wednesday night's tie, which is Monaco versus Juventus. Both sounds like we're all in agreement or in consensus that Juventus are probably the side to beat. But can Hardim's young side blast through Allegri's Juventus in the same way they've done to everybody else so far? And if not, why not?
They can't, because Juventus have the best defence in Europe. And this is like defence. At the end of the day, if it's a big game, I'm going to go with the team's got a better defence, especially if it's a one-off game, because they're less likely to make them, have brain farts and make mistakes. And I think it'll be interesting to see on Wednesday if Allegri goes for 3 at the back or 4 at the back. But I really think this is Juve's year.
I do as well. I think Monaco have done superbly. They've got a brilliant team. But I do look at areas of that team. Sidibe's out injured, so it's going to be, I think, Nabil Dourar at right back and Jemison as the right-sided centre-half. That to me, when you've got players like Mandzukic and Dybala that will prey on those kind of pockets of space, I can see Juventus getting a result
tomorrow night. Sense that Monaco need to score 3 because the other side are going to score 2, if you know what I mean. They need to outscore rather than hold their opponents. out. Does that mean it's a big night for Gonzalo Higuain? Another player that, I mean, he scores by the hat for. He broke records last season in Serie A, but mainly because of his misses for Argentina, I'd say, and in other big games. He does kind of get a bit of a bad reputation. Is this the year he was bought for so much money in the summer by Juventus? Is this the year he needs to start doing it in the semi-finals and punishing a side like Monaco for their errors at the back?
He does. He very much does. I still don't think he can do it. There was a great anecdote I remember reading in Almost Your 442 about when he first went to Real Madrid, and he was looking at Raul and Van Nistelrooy doing shooting practice, and his dad walked up to him and goes, "Look at the monsters, because one day you will look like one of them." And it just never quite clicked. Like, Higuain never quite reached the Van Nistelrooy or Raul levels. It's a big game, I'm going to get my goal. Which is fine. Like, Higuain is a very good European striker, and Juventus going all in to try and win the Champions League by buying him looks like it's going
to
pay off.
I kind of thought that they bought him to win Serie A and then leave the act of winning the Champions League to guys like Pjanic, who was fantastic in the quarterfinals. And obviously Dybala as well is going to be another focus, because him versus Mbappe, it's almost like we talk about Messi versus Ronaldo. This could be two players that are duking out for the Ballon d'Or in the years to come. Obviously Dybala did the damage against Barcelona in the first leg, Juve at home. Can he do the same against Monaco, who, as you said, are a side that do give up chances to score?
Definitely. I think that is the key battle, and I think it will be. I mean, if Kylian Mbappe impresses against that defence, I've run out of superlatives for him. He's just so good. That finish in Dortmund for his second goal was just out of this world. The way he just dispatched that into the top corner was just outstanding.
The great thing about him is that, I mean, he's scoring a third of his shots, which is ridiculous. Really.
Like Messi, Marcus Rashford-esque.
Messi's like legendary stat conversion numbers, and he only puts away 1/5 of his shots, and Mbappe's getting 1/3. Yeah. So eventually Mbappe will tail off. But I think if you look at the underlying stats, Mbappe's should really have a similar goal record to Alexis Sanchez. So imagine that, you're 18 years old and you should be at Alexis Sanchez levels, but you're playing better than that already. He's the real deal. And please don't get injured. Please don't blow a knee.
That is the thing. He is so not reliant on pace. Reliant is probably the wrong word for it, but he's so good at using his pace. It would be a shame if any of that was knocked out of him. And I say, just for football, please don't let it happen. Yeah. Please go to football.
Don't get henched. Don't tear ACL.
Good advice for anyone. But do you see any weakness in this Juventus side that Monaco can expose?
The only weakness for me, which I think depends if Fabinho plays there. There's some suggestions that it might be Moutinho and Bakayoko, but I do think Monaco might get a bit of joy in some of those central areas. As great as Pjanic was, I still look at, and it's that for me is the reason at the moment. I just look at that Juventus team and trying to pick out weaknesses is a struggle. But I do think that the central midfield area, Bakayoko, obviously Chelsea like the look of him. I think he's brilliant. And personally, I probably would go for Fabinho. I think Monaco. Well,
Fabinho, he is. I can't think of one other player I would like to describe as like a midfield general in Europe right now. He's got everything. He's got the brains, got the brawn. He's just
great,
so good. He's like he's the mastermind and the driving force. So I mean, one thing I would say is Juventus looked so good against that Barcelona midfield. But I think, as everyone said after the game, that Barcelona midfield looked a bit washed, didn't it? Really,
they're old. They're off the pace, and Rakitic is, again, good, but not as good as what he should be. Yeah. As good as what you'd expect from a Barcelona quality midfielder. And that's not disrespecting him. But this is going to be, if Allegri goes four at the back, I'll be ready to see how the fullbacks go up against each other, because I think Monaco's got maybe the best fullbacks going forward. Like, something that really impresses me about Monaco's fullbacks is that when they cross, they don't do a low cross. In FIFA parlance, they don't triple tap the cross button. They do a double tap, so it goes back post, which is something you rarely see from fullbacks. I mean, I'm a United fan, and Valencia doesn't so much cross the ball as in shoot across the goal and see if someone can tap it in. Yeah.
Whereas, a cross shot.
Yeah, the cross shot. Whereas a Monaco fullback gets some real height on it, which I think, if Monaco can exploit in Juve,
but that's probably not what you want against Juventus. You've got Chiellini and Bonucci, though. Those guys are just... That's aerial superiority, isn't it?
They do it with such pace and such frequency. If you give me all the money, I won't go cannibalise Monaco. I'm going to go buy all their fullbacks because they're doing something with them.
You're going to leave Mbappe and get the fullback. Yeah. You're the true embodiment of modern football. So out of the two ties, which one do you think is going to be most entertaining?
The Monaco-Juventus game.
I think it's the Madrid game, just for context.
Ooh. Bit of fire and a bit of flair there.
Yeah. I'm going to bring another basketball analogy. For years and years and years, Michael Jordan couldn't get past the Detroit Pistons, the bad boy Pistons, and then he did, and then he won 6 NBA titles. And I think it's going to be like, it could very possibly be that for Atletico Madrid.
Wow.
There could be a year where they finally beat Real Madrid, get the hoodoo, and then that's it. They're going to be a European heavyweight for the next decade. I think it could just be that simple of just, we've got past Real Madrid now.
But now Simeone's left to go to Inter Milan and whoa, back to square one.
Simeone's
gone
to go be the Argentina match. But it's mental blocks. It very conceivably, that could be the very last North London derby that will be fraught and tight. And it could just be like, now it's just the procession of whatever's going on. Like there was a point in time where Man United would always win a Manchester derby. Whereas now, I celebrated Gabriel Jesus getting a goal ruled offside. it's shifted. And I think that's why the Madrid one's going to be my pick this week.
Speaking about Man United, they're going to be playing Celta Vigo in the Europa League this week. Anything to worry about there? In some ways, they're probably the scariest side they could have drawn. They haven't got as much hype as some of the other guys, but they've got some players doing serious business this season.
I think Celta Vigo's going to win this one. The first one. First leg, Celta Vigo's going to get it. And then shenanigans will ensue once Phil Jones is strapped to a gurney and given his painkiller injection.
Do you see any hope for United? That sounds ridiculous, doesn't it?
United are going through to the Europa League final.
Yeah?
Definitely. They will get a draw in Vigo, and then I think they will go on and win. Not dissimilar to the last round, I think they will get over the line. Not brilliantly, not with any particular flair, but
with less ACL injuries.
Yeah, here's hoping.
One thing I do know, I think all the Iago Aspas Liverpool shirts will be back out on Merseyside this week.
Why not?
So, getting them on, watching the game.
I just hope he takes a corner like the one he did against Chelsea. I really do.
What a man.
That's all I want.
Speaking of the most entertaining matches to watch in Europe this week, Lyon versus Ajax, anyone?
Yeah, why not? Who should I look out for, Greg?
Who shouldn't you look out for? Lacazette is obviously the man.
Love Lyon. I absolutely love Lyon.
They're just throwing the ball forward, and they've got some wonderful players like Fekir as well, who's absolutely sensational. Tolisso.
Great player.
You want to talk about midfielders? He is very good at the back. And Ajax, they've got the youngest squad in Europe at the moment, outside of the lesser leagues, no offence to the lesser leagues. But they're ridiculous. They've got so many teenagers coming in and out. You want to watch the future, go watch that. But some of the action around Europe, in case anyone missed it, Nice actually beat PSG.
That was spicy.
Still behind in the title race for Liga 1, though. And Bayern Munich obviously won the Bundesliga as well. I think five times in a row.
Five times.
Absolutely ridiculous. But the margin of error is getting a bit lower. I mean, Red Bull Leipzig, they're probably going to finish, 7 points behind? But that's the fewest anyone's... That's the smallest the gap's been in 5 years.
But then you look ahead to next season and think, how are they going to adjust to having European football on the agenda for them?
And Naby Keita's probably going to be gone.
Yeah, and Forsberg as well, who's been brilliant. I think he's got the most assists in Europe's top five leagues.
And Timo Werner as well, I think 17 goals, equal with Dele Alli for goals under 23. And Liverpool are certainly sniffing around him. Just to wrap up the show, we've got a few last few questions. Lord Baruda asks, which manager around Europe have you been most impressed with this year? Julian Nagelsmann, Hadim, Favre, Gurevenka, or Hasenhüttl? I don't know if I've said that. I've done the last two right there, but we all know who I'm talking about. Who have you been most impressed with?
Look, Arsenal, go get a dump truck full of money and go nick Monaco's manager.
Absolutely.
He's the guy. He's the guy you need.
Absolutely. This whole concept about who's there after Wenger is just the most flawed argument ever. Look at the semi-finals of the Champions League and you find three conceivable replacements. Okay, Diego Simeone might not be to the taste of the Arsenal board and some supporters.
Mm.
Okay, so then you look at the other semi-final and look at Jardim and Allegri, who would both do an outstanding job. Jardim has been an absolute revelation. What he's done with that team is incredible.
What's impressed me most is he came in and he was quite pragmatic to begin with, and it's only this season where he's kind of taken a handbrake off. And to me, that's good management. That's a sign that you're not wedded to one kind of ideological approach, which is probably going to have its faults and hold you back. He's flexible. He's adaptable. Not what you want, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it kind of gets overlooked a little bit. He was man in the dugout that masterminded that 3-1 Monaco win at Arsenal in the Champions League.
And that wasn't anywhere near as pretty.
No.
You can do it both ways.
Exactly. And there was this, you know, Arsenal were the overwhelming favourites. And he completely, you know, bossed Wenger on that evening. And I think the only question mark against him is whether he can drill a defensive kind of attitude, I guess, into his players. And I'd
probably say that result against Arsenal you just brought up probably suggests he can.
He can probably, it's not even can he do it. Can he do it better than Wenger? Yeah.
Well, yeah. Yeah, he can.
See, there you are. Go get him. Like, he is the most impressive European manager, and he should be, like, if in my FIFA game save, he'll be Arsenal manager next season.
There we go. Nagelsmann's done a brilliant job at Hoffenheim.
Saved them for relegation, now he's got them to the Champions League.
It's superb.
Brilliant job, but
he's going to Bayern, isn't he, really?
It's shard him.
Next question from Mitch Wadden, semi-related again. Just how ridiculous would it be for Leeds to let Monk move on?
It's not ridiculous because it's Leeds.
Okay.
I mean, they shouldn't, but if they do, you're like, oh, well, it's Leeds then, isn't it?
Yeah. Football London, West Ham interest in Monk. What do you reckon?
I find West Ham fans kind of
careful.
I know. I'm readying my answer in anticipation of a backlash. I don't get the whole desire to get rid of Bilic from fans. I really don't. Again, call me slightly naive in thinking that maybe, you know, West Ham fans probably do think it's a little bit stale, but last season was a freak from West Ham. Let's not make, you know, any kind of pretense about that whatsoever. Last season was a freak, and this season has been... It was a freak for a number of teams last season. This season has been a more realistic...
I'm not going to say it.
It's been a more realistic portrayal of the kind of expectations they should have. I think Bilic should stay, and I don't think... Would Gary Monk necessarily offer an upgrade on what Bilic is doing at West Ham? No, for me, he wouldn't. I think they would probably be in a similar position, if not worse, if he was appointed.
But at the same time, Leeds ownership, they would be stupid to let it go.
They would, absolutely. But they're Leeds, so you never know. Ben Matchell, Leeds supporter and writer for the Evening Standard and the Times, is a Leeds fan. And every now and again, I just, you know, message him going, what's going on at Leeds right now? And he goes, oh, they're in this. Like, the next big Twitter thread should be one ridiculous thing that's going on at Leeds United.
I'm sure it's already being thought of. But Celino is being pushed out of the club. Surely brighter times are coming.
You would think that, but it's football, and football is ridiculous and doesn't obey the rules of logic.
They've got a very good team, Leeds, though. They've been really unfortunate that Fulham have just been amazing. Like, I think if it is to be, I think there's... A few things can happen on the final day to kind of determine who plays who. I think either Fulham or Sheffield Wednesday will be the third team that goes up with Brighton or Newcastle. I think those two are just better than Reading and Huddersfield. Fulham are on a roll. The only thing I would say against Fulham possibly is that defensively they leak goals.
They're the Monaco of the Championship.
They're young, they
have loads of goals, they can't defend.
Scored the most goals in the division. Yeah. Like, that's no mean feat, and that's... Unfortunately for Leeds, that's why they've come short, because Fulham have just gone on an absolute
roll.
Can't
do it all through Chris Wood. Moving on, keeping on the goals, actually. Second to last question from Chelsea fan account London is Blue. They ask, why are Chelsea and Tottenham overperforming for their expected goals? Why are Arsenal so bad on a similar basis? And I think City as well, against the top teams, their expected goals, we talked about it last week, isn't very good either, as in they're not putting them away. Perhaps looking ahead to next season, does this suggest that Chelsea and Tottenham, maybe they're unsustainable in the way they're going?
Chelsea are going to be really interesting next season because they've got Champions League football as well. Yeah. And like that 3-4-2-1 can be got at in the Champions League.
Well, I mean specifically in terms of expected goals.
In terms of expected
goals. Their conversion rate, you were talking earlier about Kylian Mbappe. Chelsea as a team have been like that this season.
I think Chelsea will be fine. They have money. They're going to get Lukaku. They're going to replace Costa.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, like Chelsea have enough money to replace the personnel who are playing well above their expected goal levels to get players who will achieve a more reasonable expected goal level. I imagine Gary Cahill's not going to score that many goals next season, but the defender,
is he the secret of their expected
but
goals?
But the defender that they bring in will be the difference to do whatever. You know, with Spurs, it's simply Christian Eriksen.
That's speaking similarly to what I was saying about Spurs and Liverpool earlier. That's the remarkable thing about Chelsea is they could feasibly end this season as double winners, and yet I think all of us would clearly be able to identify weaknesses in that team, in that you would say Cahill probably needs replacing, Alonso probably needs replacing, Matic probably needs replacing, and Costa probably needs replacing. Yet that's a team that will go on, which just for me just speaks volumes of how brilliant a job Conte has done, in that he's aware of those weaknesses and yet he's still extracting the very best out of each and every player.
One to look out for next season as they try and evolve the team. Very last question on the podcast. Matt Brownie Cakes asks, how did you know you wanted to write about sport for a living?
I don't write about sport for a living.
You have done.
I have done. How did I know I wanted to? I read something by a reporter and found out how much money they were on. I went, well, I'm at least worth like 10% of him. Why not? And then someone gave me some money. This boy bought me a pizza. It was nice.
The honest truth?
Yeah.
I was adamant I was going to be a footballer until about the age of 11. It quickly became a reality it wasn't going to happen. So my nan, who brought me up, sort of sat me down one day and said, right, okay, you might not be a footballer. What's the second best prize? And it was kind of dawned on me that if I couldn't play it, then reporting on it would be the second best thing that could happen, really. So,
and your pen work was better than your footwork.
That's a brilliant way of putting it. thanks for that.
No,
I say brilliant, almost sort of, a backhanded compliment, but I'll take it.
You're editor for a reason.
Yeah.
Go check out football.line.
Definitely. Anything you want to plug before we end the show?
Talking Tactics, my own football podcast, went live this morning. We talked at length about Muntari's racist incident. Well, the racial incident involving Sulley Muntari in Serie A, and basically what needs to be done outside that no to racism advert that you see in Champions League games. So check it out. Talking Tactics. We're on SoundCloud and iTunes.
Do it. Anything you want to be plugging for Football London this week, Tom?
We Chelsea, Spurs and Arsenal fans record our latest Chelsea Blue is the Colour podcast yesterday, which spoke about what happens to Cesc Fabregas this summer. Obviously he was brilliant when he came on against Everton at the weekend, but there's obvious doubts about his future when Conte's looking at Bakayoko, etc. So we spoke about that. We spoke about whether Lukaku passed his audition at the weekend or not, and we also talked about Cesar Azpilicueta. Kev Byrne, who I know Carl Anka knows very well, went into great length about how much he enjoys Azpilicueta's smile, so that that was great. And we're recording our Arsenal and Spurs podcast later this week as well. So yeah, do check those out and come to football.london and check out the new site.
Very good. And just a quick plug for Football Beyond Borders, who are staging their Community Cup, London's biggest community football event, on Sunday the 7th of May. They've asked me to give them a shout out. Rudimental's going to be there, apparently.
Oh.
And lots of great celebrities and what they call influencers these days, the kids are calling influencers. They're all going to be playing. Tickets are all the information on their website. Actually, if you search for Football Beyond Borders, check that out. Find lots of lovely information there. Guys, thank you so much for coming on. Carl, it's been a pleasure as always.
Yeah, it's been great. I always love coming on here.
Yeah. Tom, thank you for coming in as well.
Not a problem. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Join us again join us again on Friday, where I'll be hosting another podcast, and then we'll be back on Monday as well. We'll also have a little segment from Not the Top 20, George Ellick and Ali Maxwell's Championship and Football League podcast dropping tomorrow. So do check that out and see you again soon.
Moro Casino. America's Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.